right. Okay. Please take a seat. And well, I'll let you stand, and you can certainly stand also. Yes. And we are now moving to our next speaker. So, introductions, please.
Oh, that's with the projector here.
See, that's what happened when I'm so generous.
So finally, our last speaker, I'm pleased to be able to introduce.
Last but not least,
certainly. Vanessa De La Piedra. Vanessa is the groundwater unit manager at the Santa Clara Valley Water District. She has over 17 years of experience in water resources management and is a registered civil engineer in California. She holds a bachelor's of science degree in geology from Northern Arizona University and a master's degree in civil and environmental engineering from Stanford University. And we brought her here today because for many years, the Santa Clara Valley Water District has been a proactive leader in groundwater monitoring and collaborating with stakeholders to protect groundwater resources in Santa Clara County. And today she'll be talking to you about the district's regional groundwater monitoring program. Thank you, Vanessa.
So good afternoon, Chair Wolf, members of the board. Thanks for having me here today. Just as a brief introduction to who we are and what our mission is, essentially our mission is to provide Silicon Valley with safe, clean water. And we do that through water supply, flood protection, and watershed stewardship services. We serve 2 million residents of Santa Clara County. We're a special act district, and we were formed for the purposes of managing groundwater. We have a long history of groundwater management. And we sustainably manage local groundwater subbasins for the benefit of the community and well owners, including water retailers and also over 4,500 individual well owners. So groundwater is the foundation of our water supply in Santa Clara County. We manage two primary subbasins, which are shown here. Hopefully it's kind of visible. The Santa Clara subbasin, which is outlined in green, this is the northern portion of the county. It includes San Jose, Mountain View, Palo Alto, essentially the heart of Silicon Valley. It's highly urbanized, and it's about 300 square miles. But I'm going to focus a lot today on the Llagas subbasin, which is to the south. It's about a third of the size of the Santa Clara subbasin. It's outlined in brown here, and it contains the cities of Morgan Hill and Gilroy. But beyond those areas, it's still largely rural and agricultural. And the Llagas subbasin does fall within the Central Coast region, which is why I'm focusing a bit on that today. So countywide, groundwater accounts for about 40% of the water that's used every year, but that increases dramatically when we head to the southern portion of the county, and specifically in the Llagas Basin, 95% of all the water used comes from groundwater, and it's the sole drinking water supply. So because it is such a critical water supply source, to make sure that it continues to be sustainable, we very actively manage the groundwater basins through groundwater recharge projects and protection projects. And we also conduct very extensive groundwater monitoring. So that includes measuring groundwater levels at over 200 wells every month. We monitor land subsidence in the northern portion of the county where it's been a very significant issue historically. Happy to say that's no longer the case, but we're vigilant in making sure that that doesn't resume. And then of course, groundwater quality, which we monitor throughout the county, and I wanna focus on that today. And you're right, this is very sensitive. Okay, so I want to start with our regional groundwater quality monitoring program. Really, this is meant to help us by providing us data to allow us to assess the conditions of the basin, what's going on with different parameters, how things are changing over time, where we may have potential issues or adverse trends, so that we can take action, which may involve working with regulatory agencies to try to minimize the threat to groundwater resources. Another important feature of our groundwater data is that it helps us to assess how we're doing against our performance metrics that we've outlined in our groundwater management plan. So this has very specific numeric targets for groundwater quality. And this plan, we're proud that we've had these targets in place for many years. It's taken on a new significance with SGMA. Now we've submitted this plan as an alternative to a groundwater sustainability plan.
That was going to be my question. Is it a DWR designated basin?
Yes, both subbasins are.
Medium or high priority?
The Santa Clara Subbasin is a medium priority, and the Yaugas is a high, mainly because of the reliance on groundwater. So we have sampled groundwater quality for many decades through various efforts, but we've had a regular annual monitoring program since about 2000, and our network has evolved over time, and it really is a mix of dedicated monitoring wells that we've installed in areas where we have had data gaps, wells that we've obtained. So for example, a contaminant release site that may be closing, if it's in an area where we have a data gap and they apply for a well destruction permit, there have been times where we take advantage of that and work to acquire the well. But we also take advantage of privately owned wells, and those are primarily domestic wells, and especially in the Yaugas subbasin, as you'll see in a moment. So we sample about 90
wells. Sorry, tough question. Yeah. So, privately owned wells are cooperative, and you don't have a problem reaching out to them and having them provide data?
Well, we actually go and sample from the wells, and as other speakers have mentioned, sometimes it's challenging. You know, we may approach a number of well owners, some of them not willing to allow us to come and sample, but we're typically able to find some that will and see the benefit of it. So our goal is to sample the same set of wells consistently so that we have a long period of record and can make comparisons over time. However, that does change, and typically it is due to loss of access, and that does happen. Sometimes property may change hands, especially with the domestic wells, and the new owner may decide that they don't want us coming on their property. So in that case, we'll have to work to find a replacement well. We conduct regional sampling every fall, and it's a pretty major effort. We basically have two staff out in the field full-time for about a month or more. We have a laboratory, our own district laboratory, which is a state-certified laboratory on site, which is great. It helps us. And we analyze all the samples that we collect for major ions, nutrients, and trace elements every year. Every 3 years, we also sample volatile organic compounds. Because it is Silicon Valley, we do have contaminant release cases. Typically, we see some low-level detections. Fortunately, our drinking water supplies are not really impacted, but it is something we want to keep an eye on every 3 years at least to make sure that it's not a problem. What you don't see on here, and I want to point out, especially after Cheryl's speech, is that we don't regularly monitor for pesticides, and that is because previous sampling, very infrequently detected at very low levels, so it's not something that we monitor on a regular basis. But we do collect data from public water systems, so we are always on the lookout for any kind of changing conditions, and then we can decide to add things to our regional program. And occasionally, we use this network for special studies. If there's a particular contaminant that we're interested in, we'll just add it to the list and collect samples for it in the fall. So to give you a better sense of what our regional groundwater quality network looks like, this shows the distribution of the wells that we sample every year in the fall for both the shallow zone and the principal zone. Shallow zone is on the left and the principal zone on the right. And most of the water supply wells are screened in what we call the principal zone. And our geology is pretty complex, but for data summary and reporting purposes, we kind of simplify this by saying anything less than 150 feet is shallow. Anything deeper is principal. So you can see we have some differences. With the shallow network, these are primarily true monitoring wells that are owned by the district versus the principal zone, which tend to be more heavily domestic wells that we don't own. So again, there is that risk that we don't necessarily have ongoing access to these wells. What you can see is that we're trying to have a pretty good spatial distribution to make sure that we're getting kind of representative conditions. And we do target wells where we know the construction. We want to know not only how deep it is, but also the screen intervals. And that is the case for nearly all of these wells. There are a handful of domestic wells where we only know the total depth. So again, that is one of the drawbacks about relying on domestic wells for samples. We supplement the data that we collect through this regular fall sampling with other sources that are available to us, and the two primary sources that we use are data from public water systems that's reported to the Division of Drinking Water. So we go to the DDW website, pull that data, and associate it with wells within our subbasin, It's a great supplement that helps us fill in the gaps and understand deeper zones principally. And then also we have a domestic well testing program, which is a voluntary program. And through that program, we're typically sampling about 200 to 300 wells every year. And I'll talk a little bit more about that and what that looks like. So essentially, through this program, we're reaching out to well owners and letting them know that we will come to their residence, we will collect a sample, we'll analyze it, and we'll give them the results, all at no additional cost to them. And we do sample pretty basic, more common contaminants, nitrate, bacteria, TDS. And we really see this as a win-win kind of program. It helps the domestic well owners understand the quality of their drinking water, and it helps us to fill in the gaps in terms of the occurrence of nitrates. So that's really how we can justify this and make this a successful program. So it is voluntary. So the wells that we sample under this program vary every year. We do get some repeat samples, not as many as I would think. If somebody was offering me free sampling, I would think I would take advantage of it every year. But we do have some repeat customers, so we can see some changes over time at individual wells.
So in the non-repeat, is there any correlation to tests which were perhaps not as positive? So if you had areas of exceedance, like, well, okay, thank you.
That's a good question, and we haven't looked at that, and that would be something interesting to look at. Mm-hmm. We have looked at, you know, sometimes people will repeat every second year or every third year, so it may not be every year, and it seems to be fairly random in terms of the frequency.
Yeah, of course. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Following on that, if you do find exceedance, what is the procedure and how much technical assistance or capacity do you have?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we actually, if any MCL is exceeded, and this is kind of a short list, so when we test for nitrate, we also get fluoride and sulfate. If there's any exceedance of any primary drinking water standard, or if there's any bacteria present in the well, either total coliform or E. coli, we will call the well owner and explain to them the results. We have an informational sheet that we send. We mail all the laboratory report and also an informational fact sheet within about 3 weeks of the event. So that also explains kind of what it is, how you can treat it. And specifically with nitrate, we are offering rebates of up to $500 for reverse osmosis systems. So we'll also let them know, hey, if you have high nitrate, we have this program available. You know, we're happy to tell you more about it and help guide you through the process. So this really is a great supplement. Even though it's point data, we don't always know the well construction, especially within this program. We have a much higher frequency where we don't necessarily know the construction, but we still see it as valuable just in terms of point data that tells us the concentration in that location.
How are you funding the rebate program?
That's a good question.
Was just going to ask the same question. I said, come on, bring that program here.
In 2012, I believe it was, we had a countywide ballot measure that was called the Safe Clean Water and Natural Flood Protection Program. And so that included a program aimed at well water quality and these rebates. And unfortunately, we're not seeing very good participation. We're really trying everything we can in terms of outreach, but it hasn't really caught on yet. But we continue to look for ways to improve the participation in that.
Thank you.
Sure. Okay, so what does all this cost us? Just focusing on groundwater quality, and these numbers here are countywide. We think this is critical. You have to understand the condition of the basin so that you can manage it. So we invest a lot of money in monitoring. And specific to groundwater quality, it's about $750,000 a year. And that includes everything from making sure we have access, maintaining our network, actually doing the field work, all the lab analysis time, all of the office time to analyze the results, which can be significant to make sure that we're making good interpretations. Data management, including databases. We have very large databases, and that's a continual effort for us, especially with all our water level data. It's just kind of a constant onslaught of data. And also reporting. We want to make sure we share that information out. So our monitoring program, like all our other groundwater management programs, are funded primarily by groundwater charges. And these charges are paid by well users in areas that benefit from our programs like managed recharge. Yeah.
Could you repeat what you just said?
The funding?
Yes.
Yes. So we have basically groundwater benefit zones where the activities that we implement, like groundwater recharge or groundwater protection, benefit the subbasin and the well users. So when people pump water within those zones, they pay us a charge based on the volume of water pumped. And so those charges are the primary funding mechanism for all of our groundwater management activities.
So you're way ahead of the curve on GSPs.
And that's something that was embedded in our district act since way back. And it's, I mean, really having the funding is essential to being able to manage a basin, right? Yeah. To be able to study anything or implement programs, you have to have a reliable funding source. So we're fortunate to have that.
So if I may ask a follow-up question. So you, sounds like you're not codependent on grants. You may get some grants, but you have a mechanism to be financially sustainable in performing these activities.
Yes, and we do look for opportunities for outside funding whenever we can,
but
it is nice to have the stability of this funding mechanism.
Because a lot of basins, looking at a grant, which is going to carry them for a few years, and then after that is, how are we going to fund this?
Right.
Great job.
So your alternative plan is already approved by DWR, or?
It's being reviewed right now, and we're expecting a decision by the end of the year. And hopefully it will be approved. Okay, so we collect and analyze a lot of data, and we do want to share that with interested well owners and stakeholders. So these are a couple examples of how we do that. On the left is an image from our annual groundwater report. We publish this typically in June every year, and it provides information for the previous calendar year, so we're working hard on that right now. This has really detailed information on all of our groundwater management activities for the prior year, so how much we recharged where, what was the source, what do we do for well inspections and permitting, what kind of land use reviews, all of those types of activities, and it presents all the interpretation of all the monitoring data that we've collected the prior year. So in terms of groundwater quality, we have very detailed summary statistics by subbasin and aquifer zone. We're looking at trends, we're comparing to drinking water standards and other things. So that's a pretty informative report. I left a few copies here with Taya in case anyone's interested in taking a look at that. And these are posted on our website as well. And then on the right is what we call the groundwater quality summary report. This is similar in concept to a consumer confidence report that public water systems are required to produce. It's not required for us, but again, we see this as kind of an informational piece. It's a couple-page flyer. It talks about nitrate and some of our programs available and why it's important, and we send this to all well owners each summer. So results, kind of in line with what James talked about and other things. You know, what does all this data tell us, and what does it mean? Well, we know we have contaminant release sites throughout the county. Fortunately, those haven't had a major impact on our drinking water quality. You guys are probably most familiar with the Olin perchlorate case, and we think that all the regulatory agencies are doing a great job managing those, and we're seeing really good progress. In terms of the regional quality, what we see is that it's typically very good throughout our county, with the exception of nitrate, which is our biggest ongoing challenge. And so what's shown here, this is a figure from our 2016 annual report for both Santa Clara and the Yaga subbasins. And it's a little bit hard to see, but essentially this shows for each well tested, for all the parameters that were tested, and that varies, were there any exceedances of an MCL? And so a black dot indicates that no, there were none. An orange dot, which it's a little bit hard to see, but essentially mainly in the Yaga subbasin, and there's one up in the northwest Santa Clara. Those are exceedances of nitrate, MCL. So we see this as kind of our biggest ongoing challenge, and the note there from our monitoring in 2016 at least, about 1 in 4 wells in the Yaga subbasin have nitrate above the MCL. And again, these are primarily domestic wells. We also do trend analysis. I told James I want to connect up and compare our notes because it depends on what wells you're using and the years and everything else. But When we look at the longer term trends, the news is a little bit more encouraging for us. Most of the Augusta Basin wells either have stable or decreasing trends for nitrate. And this figure is also from our annual report. There's a lot going on in there, but essentially it's showing arrows up or down for wells that are increasing or decreasing, and there's either hollow or fill for principal or shallow zones. So what we see is that it's a mix, and we see some patterns, and we try to interpret what, you know, potentially why some of those patterns are. So for example, we believe that some of our managed recharge is helping to dilute, and so some of the positive trends we see are in response to that. But we do this type of analysis every year, and this is summarized in our annual report. So we're looking at 15 years of data, and we're using any well that has at least 5 sampling points during that period. You can see the detail on the left in terms of the summary. In the shallow zone, mostly stable trends, about 8% decreasing. It's a little more positive in the principal zone, where we see 33% of wells with decreasing trends. So certainly this is better than seeing increasing trends, but I think we all like to see improving conditions and more wells. Yeah.
So can you go back one? So you're showing stable and decreasing, and that pretty much covers it. So there's not much left that's increasing.
11%.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we show stable and decreasing. I should have mentioned this. When I talked about our groundwater management plan and the targets that we have, so one of our targets is that 90% of wells have stable or decreasing trends for nitrate, TDS, and chloride.
Wow.
So that's kind of our measure, what we want to see. We don't always get there. Sometimes we're just a little bit under, but that's kind of what we're aiming for in terms of positive trends. So just in terms of what we're trying to do to address this ongoing challenge, monitoring. I mean, it's always first for us, again, to manage it, you have to understand it. So we'll continue to be vigilant and monitoring. And to do that, we're always looking for ways to improve our monitoring network. And in the Yagas subbasin in particular, you can see that we rely a lot on domestic wells. That's different than the northern portion of the basin where we have more true monitoring wells. So I think that's something we'll be looking at long-term because we see a lot of value in depth discrete wells. Especially in the Santa Clara subbasin, we have a series 8 or 9 wells where we have sites nested wells up to 1,000 feet deep where we have individual 4 to 5 wells within a single borehole at different depths. And it gives us incredibly valuable information on how water quality changes over those intervals. They're not cheap, of course, but it's a pretty important investment. So that's something that we'll be looking at also for the Augusta Basin. In terms of reducing well owner exposure, I mentioned the free well testing program. Again, we want to help well owners understand if nitrate's a problem for them. And if it is, we have this rebate program that we would be really glad if they would take advantage of. Finally, just working to reduce nitrate in groundwater through implementing activities from our salt nutrient management plan, working to improve irrigation and nutrient management efficiency with growers in coordination with resource conservation districts. I mentioned our managed recharge program, which is really, I think, key in helping to dilute nitrate and other contaminants. We're adding huge volumes of water with very low nitrate levels to the basin, so certainly that's helpful. And lastly, but very importantly, supporting the work of regulatory and land use agencies who really have more direct authority to influence nitrate loading to groundwater. So to that end, we're happy to share data and information, engage on policies and projects related to groundwater protection. Yeah.
Do you happen to know how many, what in, within your water district, how much acreage is in irrigated ag production? Do you know?
I do not know that.
Guess?
The Yagas subbasin is about 90 square miles, and I would guess maybe 30 to 40%. That's a wild guess. I don't know.
Okay.
People in this room would probably know better than me, your staff.
Yeah, well, it just gives me kind of an idea.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure.
So and the water that you said you're putting large volumes of relatively low nitrate water in, that's reservoirs driving percolation ponds?
Yes, so we have, we capture local upper watershed runoff in reservoirs, and we also import large volumes of water from the Sacramento San Joaquin Delta. And both of those sources are low in nitrate.
And you're using that for per pump?
Yes, and we also do in-stream recharge through creeks.
Thank you so much for your presentation. I just had a quick question about your last point, supporting regulatory and land use agencies. Do you have a formalized agreement with land use agencies, or do you just check in with them? There's no sort of, okay.
No, that's basically by engaging through policy, like the on-site wastewater treatment system policy or specific land use. Because nitrate is such an issue, whenever we get land use proposals in Yaga sub-basin, that's always one of the things we're looking at. Will this contribute more nitrate to the basin?
Appreciate the engagement, though. That's helpful. Thanks.
So in your water augmentation portfolio, percentage of recycled water from water treatment facilities, if applicable, like Title 22 water?
Yeah, so in the Yaga sub-basin, we do have the South County Regional Wastewater Authority. It's in Gilroy, and they do produce tertiary treated recycled water that's used for various irrigation and industrial purposes. I believe it's about 2,000 acre feet a year, so it's a few percent of the supply in that area.
All right. And I know I looked at one time at the rates you use for agriculture use, and you have a tier system.
Yes, so our district act says that we will collect fixed volumetric charges, but it sets the agricultural rate at no more than 25% of the non-agricultural rate. So that's baked into our district act. And then our board has adopted various policies that is even lower. And they do that to incentivize continued agriculture in the southern part of the county.
Yes, because I had reviewed a survey of the different rates for irrigation. And you know, when I looked at this your area, intuitively, I thought it would be very expensive water for farmers, but actually very reasonable rates.
It's a very, very reasonable rate.
But you also have exactly, you know, they become an endangered species in in that area, you know, the farmers, that is. And what type of, and I know it's a slight sidetrack from water quality, but what type of incentives for water conservation do you have? I assume you have those for irrigation efficiency, et cetera.
Absolutely. So we have many, many water conservation programs in general countywide, everything from residential to landscape, including irrigation. I don't know the details offhand, but certainly we do work with growers, like I said, through resource conservation districts to offer irrigation efficiency. We have irrigation efficiency rebates. We have turf replacement rebates, various efforts to try to minimize outdoor water use.
Thank you. Well, I think very, very, very impressive. Congratulations. And thank you for bringing this role model presentation. I don't think we need to say best of luck with DWR to approve your plan, because like I said, I think you're ahead of a lot of basins in California.
You know, thank you.
But you started 15 years ago.
Right. So we look forward to continued collaboration with the Central Coast Board and your staff. I think we enjoy a really great relationship, and I see a lot of collaboration in our future. So thank you.
Well, thank you for a very informative presentation. Sure. Mr. Robertson, additional comments?
Okay, I think we're headed to the wrap right now. So I think Angela, Ms. Schroeder will be providing sort of a summary of today
and
wrap comments.
Perhaps what we could do, because this would be helpful, I have speaker cards, and it may be good to go through, you know, the speaker cards now, because you may incorporate in your summary, you know, some thoughts associated with some of the comments. So I will start with
And Gillespie, which was for
Gillespie,
for this particular item, it was still listed as item, as this particular item 8.
From Slough County.
From Slough County.
She left.
Okay. All right. So then we move to Abby.
Good afternoon. Abby Taylor Silva, Vice President of the Grower Shipper Association of Central California. I'm just commenting a little bit on some information that's presented today and in the staff report. There was information that noted that staff has gathered literature-based nitrogen removal values for approximately 85% of all acres of crops that are reported within the TNA reports. So it's important to note a few things related to those numbers listed in the report. First, all of these reference single studies that I can tell, not multiple studies, and we must remember that harvest removal values may be significantly influenced by a number of factors, and those could be varieties, which might mean they have very different root structure sizes, or they might be better situated as a spring crop versus a late summer or fall crop, and they could also have different bed size and spacing needs, soil types, temperatures and evapotranspiration rates, timing of their harvest. All of these things could really influence those values. And also of these studies, some of the harvest removal values were really incidental data points that came out of the research, but that wasn't really the purpose of the study necessarily in some of them. Not all, but some of them. And I think as the estimations of loading that are being made by the regional board are based upon these values, it was really of great importance to you and to us that as we prepare for Ag Waiver 4.0, that we work together to identify opportunities for more research. These values should be considered temporary placeholders, and it should be also noted that there's language in the East San Joaquin order, page 42 for your reference, footnote 121, and it reads, published values for many crop coefficients are already available in the scientific literature, and others are expected to become available in the near future. We acknowledge that some of these coefficients warrant further refinement, such as potentially based on crop varietals or regional characteristics. And then further, the State Water Board encourages that the coefficients be refined over time. So we hope that the regional board will work collaboratively with agriculture to identify gaps and opportunities for refinement. Additionally, we were very happy to hear the Santa Clara Valley Water District's presentation. They've done a lot of good work over many years. We had also encouraged that the Pajaro Valley Water Management Agency and the Salinas Valley Basin Groundwater Sustainability Agency speak, and I know there wasn't enough time on the agenda is what we were told, but we really hoped that you can hear from them in a future agenda. They're doing some pretty phenomenal things. The Pajaro Valley is similar to Santa Clara in that they've submitted their plan to DWR. Salinas Valley is working on their plan right now. I think you'd be really interested in what they're doing. Thank you.
Sure.
One question, Abby. Thank you for your comments. I appreciate your points and sort of cautioning, you know, how limited the those values are. And I think we're just starting on a very long process. So it's good to hear your perspective on that. I am very curious, though, are you aware of any work that's going on internally within the industry relative to our area? On those harvest removal values, is there any research coming out of Davis or any of our other fine research groups that you're aware of?
We're talking about how to best assess all of that information ourselves. So yeah. I don't have a lot to share right now, but it's definitely a topic that's being discussed. Mm-hmm. And like we've shared before, we have a water committee. We have a specific committee that's just looking at irrigated lands, and that's something we're absolutely talking about.
Yeah. That's okay. So because I do think that some of the, I mean, our technical support and research assets have been engaged from all sources of funding support, mm-hmm. as well as kind of the way in which a farmer would look at something versus just off-the-shelf scientific theory,
right.
you know. Mm-hmm. And I think the more that the practitioners are involved in those dialogues, I think there's more value and I think there's more confidence what's coming out of it. So I'm looking forward to ways in which the farm community itself is pushing on those investigations because they're desperately needed.
I agree.
The sooner the better, right?
Agreed, yeah, thank you.
Good, thank you.
Okay. Yeah, I'll just add to that, you know, several of our California universities are actively engaged. You know, Davis, Fresno State, that's your new home, Jessica. You know, sorry, you're gonna miss Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. You know, that's the other university that's quite active. And also, our staff is engaging, and Chris is working also with CDFA, you know, because themselves have a whole target area on this topic. So there's a lot of work being mm-hmm. currently done. But mm-hmm. thanks for bringing these comments, Abby.
Thank you.
So our next speaker card is Mr. Schimmick. That was a test. Trust me, that was not done with any malicious intent.
Good afternoon, everyone. Steve Schimmick with the Otter Project in Monterey Coastkeeper. So this is a little bit of a laundry list kind of thing, so don't expect some nice flowing dialogue. First of all, I think that you should recognize, and this goes to one of Chair Wolf's questions of DPR, the pesticides themselves are a good tool, I think, for dating that water. In other words, if you have a pesticide that wasn't used until 1990, and then it shows up in the water, or let me actually use water. So DCPA was used in 1970s, and then it was detected in the 1990s. That's a pretty rapid percolation rate. Now, you don't know the depth of that well. You don't know a lot of things. But that pesticide made it to groundwater in 20 years. I think if you look at imidacloprid, it seems to be maybe even faster. In other words, it's very recently used, and now it's turning up in groundwater samples. So in other words, to your question of, is this legacy water or is this new water? I think you have some additional evidence that some of this is new water. My second point, boy, I'm not picking on you. Maybe it's the buzzer thing. But the reverse is also true. Not only does surface water become groundwater, but groundwater becomes surface water, especially in the Salinas Valley, the area that I'm most familiar with. The only water that we have in some of our streams in the summer is irrigation tailwater that then drains into these ditches and streams. And that irrigation water is groundwater. So my point being is if you have imidacloprid or some of these pesticides in the groundwater, that is quickly going to become surface water, which is going to be carrying those pesticides. My next point, if you wanted to pursue it, one of the consultants that we hired about, I want to say 3 years ago, to consult on the expert panel recommendations was a consultant from Santa Barbara by the name of Dr. Mark Cram that worked on telemetering wells. And he felt so strongly that you could telemeter monitoring wells and then get real-time data that you didn't even have to go out in the field with. He actually applied for a National Science Foundation grant to try and test this idea. And he found a sensor company that was willing to provide the sensors for free. So my point being that I think that there is an opportunity here using local science, and I would be happy to provide that report from Dr. Cram if you would like. I think it actually, it's very forward thinking and very interesting. Thank you.
So let me ask you, Steve, telemetry on water level or constituents of the water?
So he was basically saying, let's use the water level monitoring well, because we know all those physical features of those monitoring wells. So he was basically saying, and then you could telemeter those for, the suggestion was actually nitrates. He believes that there is a sensor for that. And he, this guy is into, why do we always have to go out in the field and collect these samples and send them? Let's wire water quality.
Thank you. And I think we took notes, so thank you, Steve. Appreciate it. So the last speaker card I have for this item is Claire.
Good afternoon. My name is Claire Weinman. I'm the president of the Grower Shipper Association of Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo counties. We absolutely agree with the importance of salinity and nitrate in understanding the relationship between the two. They're a package deal. Unfortunately, in the Santa Maria watershed, they dammed the wrong river. It was the Twitchell Reservoir was on the Cuyama River rather than the Sisquoc, and it's very naturally high in salts. And so even though we appreciate the quantity of the water that it helps with recharge, have some wish lists on the quality of the water. But I think the essential question that we're all looking at is, how can we get more wells to show that downward trend, especially the shallow wells? And we sincerely believe that pump and fertilize is an important part of the solution. We recognize it's not the only piece, but it's an essential component. So where are we going to get the most benefit from pump and fertilize? It would seem that that would be the shallow wells, right? You know, there tend to be higher levels and a little bit more accessible, but, you know, some of the reasons that people might not use those shallow wells would include, you know, that shallow water comes with baggage. It's also higher in salts. It's a package deal, and for crops like strawberries and lettuce that are very sensitive to salinity, it wouldn't meet those water quality needs. But the other thing that's of concern and increasing concern is regulations that create a policy disincentive to use those shallow wells. It started with the Ag Order 2.0 with the nitrate loading risk, triggering whether or not you'd have to do the total nitrogen applied reporting. And we're definitely looking to the treatment of nitrate in irrigation water in future, current and future total nitrogen applied analysis and reporting. We believe it's important to recognize and honor the limitations to better resolve them, and so understand what are the reasons that people might not want to use those shallow wells and how can we address it. So how can we encourage farmers to use those shallow wells, and how can we make sure that we don't create a regulatory environment that discourages the use of shallow wells with higher nitrate concentration versus using deeper wells that have less baggage? You know, we've tried to emphasize this point, and, you know, I say this with all humility, but we really think that Eastern San Joaquin got it wrong, got it very, very wrong on pump and fertilize, and we're very, very concerned about the ramifications on the long-term health of the Santa Maria groundwater basin. And so we're hopeful that pump and fertilize and the utilization of shallow wells will be a top priority in 2020, the regulatory program. And we're eager to engage with staff and the board to achieve this goal for the benefit of our basin. Thank you.
Thank you, Claire. Again, I'm going to ask you the same question. Is your organization seeing or encouraging discussion among the growers of these issues? Do you have a working group, or are you engaging with researchers to look at what those incentives could be that, as you point out, you know, would encourage the right practices that make sense?
Yes, you know, definitely working with Abby and our other partners and trying to understand that, trying to understand the precedential aspects. And, you know, one of my members is a very passionate advocate and, you know, is probably one of those data points that showed that. And, and so I think the biggest thing is to have people keep using it and that we're going to continue to refine our understanding and our ability to manage that. But if you've moved away from that entirely, if you say, you know, this is too much, I'm going to, you know, inactivate or decommission the well. That's what we don't want. We want people to, or I will only speak for me personally. I think that we, you know, it's to our benefit to, at least in the meantime, as we continue to refine our understanding and our management practices, to keep people using those in the meantime. And we'll, you know, continue to make progress and on all the other kind of the source control, you know, reducing the loading on that
end too.
But in the meantime, let's not shut that down and close that opportunity. So whether in the meantime or in the long term, we can better use that water and utilize that water.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the more clarity there is from the farmers, the growers, on what disincentives could look like or could, you know, actually emerge like an unintended consequence, you know, that I think that's one thing this board has been very, and I know myself, been very, very focused on hearing, listening for things that we believe to have a certain outcome. And in practice, we might see that outcome, but there might be other aspects to it that are you know, contra to what we're trying to do, or in some way, you know, causes some disruption or some negative impacts to farmers. So those are things that, you know, we really do need to make sure remain in the dialogue, active in the dialogue, as controversial as they might be sometimes. So I am hoping that we can continue to push through those limitations, you know, what's good, easy to talk about versus where we issues that we really need to focus on.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Claire, I have a question. I'm trying to understand what you're saying, and I'm feeling a little thick. Are you saying that it's when you're talking about a disincentive to use shallow well water, are you saying that the disincentive is when we're trying to limit total light nitrogen loading and including the nitrogen in the irrigation water? Or is it something more complicated than that?
That, and then that's a big one. And then I think, especially if you're looking at average nitrate concentration for all of the wells versus a primary irrigation well, I think those are two examples of things. And certainly under the Ag Order 2.0, the nitrate risk calculation, were all factors that we see as being detrimental.
So what you're saying it is a little more complicated than just counting the nitrate in the well water, although you'd love it if you didn't have to do that, because that would encourage shallow well use. But that it's also how the calculation is done in terms of the different wells on someone's property.
Yes, that's a factor.
That's helpful.
If there are multiple wells, but the biggest thing is are you immediately looking at the total nitrogen applied inclusive of that's comes with the higher levels of nitrate in that higher nitrate concentration in that irrigation water. That's probably the bigger driver, especially for the highest concentration wells.
Thank you.
Yeah, in fact, I think it's a couple of years ago, I attended a field trip with Steve Moore, and I can't remember who else was with me from State Board. Anyway, we were in Santa Maria, and we went to one of the leafy green fields. This is a fellow who has that new technology of, you know, the micro...
The not center pivot, but it looks like a center pivot, but it's a linear.
Yeah,
movement.
That's
yes.
The one. Okay,
yeah.
So
yeah, and he couldn't be here today, unfortunately. He had a conflict in Sacramento.
Right.
But
so he gave at lunchtime a very passionate case about, you know, the unintended consequence, mm-hmm. and in fact gave specific example in the, you know, with some of his neighbors who drilled deeper wells in order to get a higher quality of water and not using the shallow well. So I think these are things that as we're increasingly looking at, you know, fertigation benefits of and a presentation that was made by UC Davis recently on you know, fertigation and the, you know, the plant being able to metabolize these. I think that's all heading in the right direction. So, yeah.
And how can we better buffer those salts too that come with that?
Yeah.
Is it, you know, looking at gypsum? You know, what's the sodium relative to the gypsum and the calcium?
Correct. Yeah. So no, that's, I think, reinforcing the point. Well taken. Thank you, Claire.
Thank you.
So at this time, this covers all our speaker cards, so I think this is an opportunity then for a wrap probably from Ms. Schroeder.
Angela Schroeder, section manager here at the regional board. So again, similar to March, this item was an informational item to talk about groundwater quality conditions and groundwater reporting in anticipation of our future discussions regarding options in Ag Order 4.0. So thank you for this opportunity to provide you with this background information. And thank you to our speakers, James, and especially to Perry, Cheryl, and Vanessa for traveling here today to provide this important information on groundwater quality conditions. As you heard from James, the good news is that we have tons of data. I think that's one of our take-home points, that those efforts to implement those new groundwater monitoring requirements and to manage that data effectively in GeoTracker has really been a benefit. The bad news is that we do continue to have very severe impacts to our drinking water, and in some cases, those nitrate concentrations are increasing, as you learned from James's talk. So, and you'll hear tomorrow about how critical it is to reduce nitrate loading. We've also heard about data gaps. So James pointed out that pesticide data is really lacking, and I think we heard a lot of information from Cheryl Gill from DPR about what they do and what maybe the limits of their authority and what the ag commissioners are doing and how we might be able to evaluate improvements to our pesticide monitoring. We also heard, for example, Dr. Wolf's comments about depth and how we need to get a better handle on depth as well as frequency of monitoring. And I think Vanessa's talk really is a great example of where they've really taken those concepts and optimized it for the Santa Clara Valley Water District. We've also, in response to Steve's comment about remote telemetry, that is absolutely an area I think that different programs are looking at in terms of monitoring. So I know, for example, Division of Drinking Water is looking at inline nitrate analyzers that can be used by remote telemetry. Our UCLA project is one of those, and certainly that application might be applicable to our agricultural groundwater monitoring too. So thanks again to our speakers. In response to Abby and Claire's comments, those will be discussed in great detail tomorrow, and Chris Rose will help to lead that conversation when we talk about part two for nitrogen loading. So with that, I think we close item eight.
Yeah, and then I wanted to make sure that today, you know, there was an opportunity for comments on this item, and we'll do the same tomorrow, because I wasn't sure if all the folks who had speaker card today on this topic were going to be in tomorrow. So in fairness, you know, wanted to allow part one and part two to still being able to comment. So, yeah.
I just have a really wild thought.
Oh.
I don't know how many of you have seen that AT&T commercial that's on television. That's I know it's on CNN. So
technology, how will you use it? Or
and
something
it's the example is farm remote sensing, and the grandfather's talking to the granddaughter and explaining to her all this stuff. But I'm wondering, do they have grants? Are they funding pilot use of this new digital technology that they have? Or maybe the device makers themselves might have small pilot grants for individual growers. And in California, especially in coastal farming, we have such diversity to offer them for their pilot study to show, you know, the how well designed or how effective, or to help them test and investigate the limits of the design, push their designs. I think that would be outstanding if we could get in line for money like that for our farmers.
That's a great question, and I bet if Abby's still here, she would know.
Did she duck out?
I believe there's a
she's
there's
here.
A technology, right? Isn't there an ag technology? I was Monica Hunter was talking about ag technology and, for example, for irrigation.
I mentioned the AT&T commercial, which I saw like 3 months ago, and I've been watching ever since. And it's one of my favorite commercials. They use the farmer as the example of remote sensing and, you know, a grandfather who's a farmer. So it's like, this is easy, it's not hard, you know. Yeah. But I'm wondering, do they have individual grants for pilot studies, or maybe the devices that go along with that AT&T service, that they might have monies for pilot use? And we have such diversity in California coastal farming. Yeah. We could be a great testing ground for.
And I was thinking about your Ag Technology Institute.
Yeah. Right? So I don't know specifically about AT&T, but that's something that we could look into. I know Mark Cady was here. There he is. And he might be able to talk about some of the things that CDFA has done, especially. We're just going to keep passing the buck on this one.
Well,
but
I can supplement a little bit, too.
Yeah, and then our Ag Tech Institute, with Western Growers, is a pretty neat place where a lot of ideas are coming together. But in terms of the AT&T funding specifically, I'll look into it.
This is taking place right now, Monica, in Paso Robles, because of the high priority, actual critical priority basin. And there are several properties which are on the pilot program where the well is monitored through telemetry. And the information is sent to their Wi-Fi connection and accessed then on their computer. And one of the reasons of these projects was to look at the cone of depression impact from outer heavy agriculture user. And in the Paso Basin, you know, there's been a lot of, should we say, frictions with large, you know, vineyard planting and the impact on the groundwater table.
Predatory grape grower.
So, predatory grape grower, all right. Oh, that hurts. And that's actually being done, and this was done through grant. Mm-hmm. So I know exactly, a couple of folks who have this program. One of the lady is in the Water Resource Advisory Committee for the county. So there's that. I saw the device. It's very simple, you know, and it goes into the wellhead with a transducer. So good point.
Such a wild idea after all.
No, but you know, after these glorious comment about AT&T, I hope you don't subscribe to Verizon.
I don't have to answer all that.
Right. So, any further parting comment, Mr. Robertson?
Somebody's raising their hand back there.
Stay tuned for part two.
Pardon me?
Stay tuned for part two tomorrow.
Oh, okay.
There is someone.
Well, but that's not a speaker card. Oh. So. Okay. All right, so we will adjourn the meeting, and it is 5 to 5 p.m. So this will close our Thursday, May 10th meeting, and we reconvene tomorrow at 9 a.m.
Same place. Thank you very much.